We're going to have our second reading now. It's from Genesis chapter 25. Genesis chapter 25. Let's begin to read at verse 29. Once, when Jacob was cooking stew, Esau came in from the field, and he was exhausted. And Esau said to Jacob, "Let me eat some of the red stew, for I am exhausted." Therefore his name was called Edom. Jacob said, "Sell me your birthright now." Esau said, "I am about to die. Of what use is a birthright to me?" Jacob said, "Swear to me now." So he swore to him, and he sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and ate and drank and rose and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. Well, we're in 1 Corinthians again this morning. This great chapter, 58 verses. 58 verses of solid theological argument in which Paul unpacks the resurrection of the dead. So it's a very deeply theological passage. It's dense in its argument. But Paul is unpacking this doctrine because, remember, the doctrine of the resurrection from the dead is, Paul tells us, a doctrine of first importance. The doctrine of the resurrection from the dead is a doctrine of first importance for the church. That's why it's very important that we understand it. We understand its nature. We should understand the hope that it should give us. It's a doctrine of first importance. It's also a doctrine, says Paul, that he received. He says that. I also received this doctrine. In other words, this isn't a doctrine that Paul made up. It's not something that he invented. It's not something that was plucked out of thin air. This was a doctrine that he received. It's not a doctrine that he made up in order to give him a platform to go out to the world to preach in the world and delude the world with a fantasy. This is something that he received. He received it from who? Jesus Christ himself on the road to Damascus. He received it also from the other apostles, from the other eyewitnesses. So says Paul, this doctrine of the resurrection is something that I received. It's not unique to him. Now, in that, Paul says, when I receive this, I just pass it on. Just pass it on. I'm just passing on to you what I receive, which actually is the job of the clergy, isn't it? The job of the clergy is just to pass on what they've received. The job of the clergy is not to put things to the vote to change what they've received so they can be seen to be very clever. We now know better than those people in the past. That's not the job of the clergy. The job of the clergy is to pass on what they've received. So it's a stance of humility. It's a stance of meekness. They're not going to change what they've received. They're just going to pass it on. And so that's what Paul says. And that's how he opens the chapter. And then you begin to think, well, why does Paul feel that he needs to emphasize this doctrine? At the end of this huge epistle, this long epistle, 16 chapters, why does Paul feel he needs to close with this 58 verses unpacking the doctrine of the resurrection from the dead? Well, we've been some time now in 1 Corinthians. You'll know what the church in Corinth was like. It was a church that was sexually very promiscuous. They thought that was appropriate behavior. They were a church that liked celebrity speakers. They were a church that liked status. They were a church that loved money, and they thought one of the ways to make money without working is just sue people and get money. There are others who thought, well, I don't want to necessarily commit to this new religion. I'll tell you what, I'll go to the pagan temples in the morning and the church in the evening. Hedge my bets. Play the two games at once. Others thought that getting drunk and sleeping with prostitutes was just appropriate behavior. They just thought that was normal. Others were insisting on their rights. And if they had a right that was flouted or somebody trampled on their rights, they got very angry. That's the sort of church they were. There are others who, in that church, who were, regard themselves as rather superior. They were the old Etonians of the ancient world, and they would look down on the uneducated and the simple. These were sophisticated, well-educated, rich Corinthians, and they looked down on everyone else in the church. Now, that's what the church was like. Now, as we look at this, you think, Paul's thinking all the time, he's thinking, well, that's inappropriate behavior. It is, isn't it? That's inappropriate behavior. So you've then got to ask the question, well, why are people behaving like that? And if you're behaving in an inappropriate way, it's because you must be thinking in an inappropriate way. That works, doesn't it? That follows. What you think, how you think, will affect the way you behave. That's obvious. So Paul is trying to drill down to the doctrine, to the fundamental principles by which they work, by which they're thinking, because that will explain how they're behaving. Now, a friend of mine, Facebooked me the other day, and she said it was rather amusing because she was driving past the Old Trafford cricket ground, and there are all these Greek Olympiacos fans, football fans, taking their photographs of themselves outside the cricket ground. You know, they're doing selfies and all there in their football gear outside the cricket ground. Now, that's inappropriate, isn't it? That's inappropriate. I mean, that doesn't work. I mean, why are they doing that? I mean, the first question you've got to ask yourself is, what's happened here? That's inappropriate behavior. Of course, what they were doing is they were thinking that the Old Trafford cricket ground was the football stadium. So that's what they were thinking, and that's why they were acting like that. It was foolish of them. They're idiots. You see? And so what Paul is saying is, I've got to drill down to this behavior. How do you explain this behavior? And actually, he's hit the nail on the head in verse 12 of 1 Corinthians 15 when he says that there's some people in the church who are saying that there is no resurrection from the dead. He says, some of you are saying that there is no resurrection from the dead. Now Paul's got it. Now Paul understands, because he's got them, he's drilled down to their most fundamental convictions. Now, you have fundamental convictions. You do. You've got fundamental convictions that are absolutely central to your life, and you behave, your behavior is growing out of those fundamental convictions. Now, it's not just you've got them. Everybody's got them. The whole of Knutsford. The whole of England, we're all fundamentalists. It's not just religious people who are fundamentalists. Everybody's fundamentalist. Because everybody's got deep convictions on which they base their life and out of which their behavior springs. And so Paul says, there's some of you who are saying that there is no resurrection from the dead. Now, if you put that to the Corinthians, they'd say, well, actually, Paul, we do believe in the resurrection from the dead. And as you unpack it, what you discover is that these Corinthians believed in the resurrection, but not in the resurrection the way that Paul understood it. They'd say things like, well, you know, Paul, the resurrection is a spiritual thing. It's a spiritual thing. It's something that happens in the spiritual realm. It's symbolic. It's just, you know, just like after winter, you get the spring. So after death, you get something nicer afterwards. It's all very vague. They speak like bishops. All very vague. Nothing concrete. That's what they're thinking. In terms of, they're thinking of the resurrection in terms of something spiritual. Not real. Spiritual. And so you can see this because they would ask Paul very difficult questions. They'd say to Paul, well, look, Paul, we're clever, sophisticated, urban, rich, metrosexual Corinthians, and we've got some really important questions for you, Paul. And Paul would say, well, what are they? They'd say, well, how are the dead raised then? He says that, doesn't he? You're talking about the physical resurrection? The resurrection of the body. Tell me, Paul, how are the dead raised? With what kind of body do they come? Answer that one, clever clogs. That's how they're talking to Paul. And you see, they'd say, look, Paul, let me make it very concrete for you. I just buried Uncle Albert. And we took his body. We took his perishable body. We took his dishonorable body. We took his weak body, his body that simply gave out at the end and smelled. That dishonorable, weak, natural, physical body. We buried it, Paul. And we put it into the ground. And that weak, natural, dishonorable, smelly body has been disintegrated. It's been eaten by the worms. And Uncle Albert is now a tulip. Anyway, they'd say, forget Uncle Albert. And people have said this to me. How do people who've turned into ash in the ovens of the crematoria, how do they raise from the dead? It's a good question. How about all those sailors in the Second World War who drowned in the sea and were eaten by fish? How are they raised from the dead? Talking about a physical resurrection, Paul, answer these questions. Are you seriously telling us that the dead are going to be raised physically, bodily? You see, what these Corinthians thought, they were more like Hindus rather than Christians. They thought that, you know, some kind of reincarnation in some sort of spiritual form. They couldn't get their heads around this idea that the body was going to be raised physically. Now, think of the consequences of this. If you think that the resurrection is something spiritual, something symbolic, something ethereal that's going to happen in the other world, way beyond death, I'll tell you what will happen. What will happen is that this real, concrete, physical, tangible world will always, always, always be more real to you than the vague, uncertain, unknown, undisclosed, non-physical resurrection world that somehow lies way beyond the grave. Is that right? When you've got a choice between something real in this world or something vague in the world to come, I will tell you 100% this world will win out. It will. And that's the whole problem with Esau, wasn't it? There was Esau. We all know about Esau. He was a hunter. He loved hunting. He would spend days out catching antelopes and rabbits and hares. That was the kind of guy he was. He was a very hairy, physical guy. And he spent weeks out hunting. There he is, out hunting. And he's coming back, and he's absolutely famished. And he comes running into the tent. There's Jacob, who never left home. Jacob was there cooking his lentil soup, making bread. You know, he's that kind of guy. And Esau says, I'm starving. I'm about to die. So Jacob says, sell me your birthright. The birthright. The birthright that promised an inheritance, that promised salvation, that promised eternal life. But Esau thought, oh, that birthright, that's all very vague. Remind me, did God give me this birthright? God is kind of like not real to me at the moment. He's kind of vaguely out there. I'm not sure who he is, but this lentil stew is right in front of me. Who is God? It's not real to me. This little soup, and I'm about to die, is real to me. And I want this lentil soup now. So I'll sell my birthright. Do you know what Paul says about that? Paul says, that is so, so, so stupid. That is madness. That is folly. That's like Olympiacos fans celebrating outside the cricket ground. What madness has possessed you to think in that way? I mean, Can you imagine those Olympiacos supporters going back to Greece? And they bump into their friends and they say, look at this. They show them. And their friend actually lived in Manchester. And he says, why are you celebrating outside the cricket ground? I mean, what would they say? Wouldn't you feel stupid? Wouldn't you feel like, oh, what an idiot? You'd be speechless, wouldn't you? Because you're exposed in all your self-pompous, selfie, photograph folly to be an idiot. Do you know Jesus said it's going to be like that on the day of judgment? On the day of judgment, those who've lived for the physical, real world here are going to be exposed and are going to be rendered speechless. Remember that parable Jesus told of the guest who went to the wedding, and he saunters in off the street and he walks into the wedding and he's just in his jeans and he's just dressed like nobody off the street, just walks in. Perhaps he didn't realize that it was a wedding. I don't know. He just walked in and sat down at the Thai table and began to eat and drink. Did you realize it was a wedding? Did you realize it was a master of ceremonies? Perhaps you thought the master of ceremonies didn't care. Perhaps you thought it was a wedding, but you thought, oh well, the master of ceremonies won't care. But the master of ceremonies did care. And it was a wedding. And the master of ceremonies comes up to him and says, where's your top hat and tails, young man? Do you know what? He was rendered speechless. He had nothing to say. And the master of ceremonies took that man and he put him out of the wedding where there was dancing and music and fun and excitement, and he goes out into the darkness. You see, this is so important. This is why Paul's wanting us to understand what the resurrection is like, so that the world, in all its physical reality, in all its immediacy, loses its grip on our hearts. So that we do start to live for the life beyond this world, and so that the life beyond this world can become more real than this world. That's the only way you're going to change. That's the only way you're going to lay hold of eternal life. That's the only way you're going to be able to say with Paul at the end of 1 Corinthians 15, death is swallowed up in victory. Oh death, where is your victory? Oh death, where is your sting? How are you going to be able to say that? You're only going to be able to say that once you've grasped what the resurrection is all about. Okay, let's get on to that. What is the resurrection all about? Well, Jesus Christ, as we know, was a man. He was a man born of a woman, born of the Virgin Mary. He was a man of the seed of David. So he had a genealogy. He had an inheritance. He had a body that was physical, that pumped flesh and blood, that pumped blood. It was a body of flesh that pumped blood. He was also, we know, the Son of God with power. Now let's just imagine, now bear with me, we're going to have to take one or two theological steps here. Let's just imagine that Jesus Christ bypassed the incarnation. So Jesus Christ, there he is, the Son of God with power, but he never took on human flesh. Let's say that that Jesus, who doesn't exist by the way, this is theoretical, bear with me, that Jesus went from the throne of heaven to hell, to the place of the dead, and then he went down into the dead, and then rose up again out of death to be reseated at the right hand of his Father. In other words, he never took on flesh and blood. He never took on flesh and blood from his mother, the Virgin Mary. He never became like us. He was just a spiritual being, which is somewhat some people like to think the resurrection is like, just a spiritual thing. If Jesus did that, if Jesus just as a spiritual man goes down into hell, goes down to death, reascends into heaven, would that have helped you? Would that have saved you? Some people say, well, actually, yes, it would. That's fantastic. Thank you. That really helps me. And you say, well, how would it help you? They say, well, I'm a very spiritual person. And I go, yeah, okay. Tell me about that. He said, well, you know, when I, I suffer a lot in this world. And I say, well, how? They say, well, I've got a lot of spiritual problems. In fact, most of my problems are spiritual. I say, well, go on, what do you mean? Well, I suffer from anxiety. I suffer from depression. I've got lots of psychological problems. So it's great that Jesus came down and just dealt with my spiritual problems. That's great. That works for me. Let's push it a bit more. That's true. You've got spiritual problems. We all have them. But you've also got a body, don't you? And doesn't your body, I mean, I don't know. I don't want to get too personal here. I'm reaching that age where I'm sensing that my body is starting to give out a bit. I remember when I first arrived, I know, a long, long time ago. I used to be able to, watch the news, take a news night, walk the dog, do some work on the computer, go to bed at 12:31 and be fine the next day. I can't do that anymore. If now I'm not in bed by 10:30, I'm a wreck. My body's giving out. So I've got this physical body that's starting to get weak. So I'm not just a spiritual being, I'm a physical being as well. And actually, when you think about it, sometimes my spiritual problems affect me physically. You know that, don't you? Some of you who are doctors and very clever and will know that sometimes when people have suffered a spiritual trauma, for example, a child dies or, a terrible spiritual trauma. And sometimes what people do is they close down emotionally. I can't deal with that. What happens? It's often been noted by doctors. I don't know if this is true or not. This is what I've read, but I'm not a medical person. Sometimes what's said is that 5 years later, they develop cancers. Where? In their spirit? No. They develop the cancers in their bodies. Why? Because of the spiritual trauma. So if Jesus Christ only came down to deal with our spiritual problems, that would only have been half a victory, wouldn't it? That would have been a real victory. That would have been a complete victory over death. That would have been half a victory. There would have been huge swathes of this world, huge swathes of existence in this world that would not have been touched by the resurrection of Jesus. It was just a spiritual resurrection. It'd be like Wellington after the Battle of Waterloo saying, well, I half beat Napoleon. What do you mean you half beat Napoleon? If you half beat Napoleon, you're actually saying you've been defeated by Napoleon. Because this resurrection, it was only a spiritual resurrection, wouldn't have helped you at all. It would have been hopeless. As I say, huge swathes of human existence would have been left under the control and sway of death. Satan would still be triumphant, and death would have been still triumphant over huge areas of your life. That's no victory. That's half a victory. But notice how Paul finishes. He says, no, no, no. He says, death is swallowed up in victory. Oh, death, where is your victory? Oh, death, where is your sting? Now, how can he say that? He can say this because Jesus is a psychosomatic unity. Now, you say to me, that's a big word. I say, no, I can actually read books without pictures in them sometimes. What does that mean, psychosomatic unity? It means Jesus was psyche, spirit, but also body. He was body and spirit. So when that Jesus goes down into the realm of death, taking his flesh from his mother and his flesh from the line of David, and also when he goes down to death as the Spirit of God with power, he goes down into death. And I love the way the old hymns talk about death. Do you know what they talk about? How they talk about? They talk about he goes down and the gloomy portals of death. I love those words, gloomy portals. This is much better than doors. Yeah, gloomy portals. They close behind him, chained, locked. So in his body, he dies. But he's also the Spirit of God with power. So the third day, Jesus walks up to those gloomy portals of death. And with a triumphant command, he commands those gloomy portals to open. And guess what, my friends? Those gloomy portals swing open. They're wide open. They're chained open. They're still open. In fact, I could even say that those gloomy portals of death have now been nailed open by Jesus Christ, the eternal Son of God, the Son of God with power and born of the Virgin Mary. I should apply this, shouldn't I? I should apply this. This is all doctrine, and people say, well, doctrine. Let's apply it. What does this mean? Okay, you're saying to me, what's the cash value of this? What's the cash value? Give me something, Nigel, that I can go away with that's actually going to make a difference to my life. You know, I've discovered a lot of people, they just can't face reality. They just can't face it. I was talking to a young man yesterday who spoke at the men's breakfast. And he's doing this PhD and he's trying to answer big philosophical questions that attack Christianity. So he's doing this job at the moment. And in 3 years' time, 4 years' time, he's going to graduate with a PhD in philosophy of mind. I think that's good. So I say to him, what are you going to do once you graduate? He said, I don't think about that. What do you mean you don't think about it? I can't think about it. I've got no idea what I'm going to do in 3 years' time. In 3 years' time, it's a huge chasm opening up in front of me, and I don't dare think about it. Do you know there are lots of people in this world, they self-medicate. Do you know how they self-medicate? They self-medicate by never thinking about the future. Caroline talks to non-Christians all the time. And you talk about death. I don't want to know. I don't want to know. Don't talk to me. My daughter's fallen ill. I don't want to know. Don't talk to me. I can't think about people getting ill. There's a war breaking out. I don't want to talk about, no, I can't think about it. People self-medicate it by refusing to think about the future. Now, Christians, we should be able to think about the future. We should be able, because why? Because we know that this world is a horrible place. We know that. Jesus said, didn't he? Listen to this. He said this. And when you hear of wars and rumors of wars, don't be alarmed. Nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. And there'll be famines and earthquakes in various places. No, I don't want to think about that. I'd rather self-medicate. Give me drugs. Give me alcohol. Give me sex. Stop me. I just can't think about that. People can't. But you know, Christians can. I think it was Tim Keller who said Christians should be the most pessimistically hopeful people in the whole world. In other words, Christians can look at life as it really is. Yes, there's death. Yes, there's cancer. Yes, there's sickness. Yes, there's wars and rumors of wars. Yes, there's disease. Yes, you can lose your job. Yes, you can become redundant. Yes, you can lose everything that you saved all your life. This is the world in which we live. But how can we live in this world by looking at it squarely, because we know of the resurrection from the dead? How does Paul put it? Paul puts it like this: therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your labor is not in vain. Fantastic. Immovable, steadfast, not alarmed, not thrown off track. Why? Because of the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. Notice that he goes, pah, to death. He goes, death, where is your victory? Death, where is your strength? We can look at life as it really is because of the hope that lies beyond the grave. One last thing. Some of you come to church, and we love you, especially these guys who are always on the periphery. We love them a lot. And they hang in, they come in, go out, come to some services, not the others. They come always when they're on duty, then they come, but otherwise, not that often. And the reason why they don't come is they've got really, really important things to do. Other things. Like walk the dog, shopping, having a lion. They've got other things to do. So they don't come to church. I spoke of a birthright. You know, Esau despised his birthright. And he bitterly regretted it. Bitterly, bitterly, bitterly. It said that he sought his birthright again with tears. But he couldn't get it back. It had been given to Jacob. Now all you people who are on the periphery, you've got a birthright. The great thing about Jesus, because he was born, and he was the first born from the dead, has come to give you back your birthright. Now, if it's a birthright that Jesus has come to bring you, how do you get it? You've got to be born again. You've got to be born again into the kingdom of heaven. And perhaps the reason why you're always just like a helicopter around St. John's, dipping in and out, is because you've never really been born again. You've never claimed this birthright. You know, it could be yours. It could be yours when you trust in Jesus and you're born again. And then you can be steadfast, immovable, abounding in the work of the Lord and laughing at the powerlessness of death. Amen.